I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. 2 weeks ago, we did a program on the problem of gun violence in Philadelphia. Since that time, 16 more people have been killed, and most of them shot with someone using a gun. The murder rate continues to climb in the city, while the national rate has been falling. And while the Aurora massacre in Colorado received national attention, the almost daily level of violence in certain neighborhoods in Philadelphia gets little mention or attention. The Violent Crime Reduction Partnership, which includes Justice Department agents, the Philadelphia Police Department, and the DA's office, has been focusing on high crime areas and the small percent of people who are responsible for most of the violence in this city. Today in Radio Times, will these new efforts make Philadelphia safer? And how does this level of violence affect residents living in these communities? And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. We invited Dorothy Johnson-Spite back on Radio Times. She is the executive director and founder of Mothers in Charge. That's a nonprofit that facilitates violence prevention and intervention programs for children, for parent education groups, and other community support services. Sadly, her son was shot and killed on December 6, 2001, and this was over a parking space in Philadelphia. And Dorothy, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Michael Resnick. He's the City of Philadelphia's Director of Public Safety, responsible for oversight and management of the Public Safety Division, and that includes the Police Department, the Prison System, the Fire Department, and the Office of Emergency Management. And Michael Resnick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Nice to have you here. Let me just begin with something that you just told me, Michael, which is that in the last, let's say, 12 hours or even less in Philadelphia, so since last night around midnight, there were six shootings in the city, two stabbings, and one homicide. This is all information that you've gotten in the last couple of hours.
That's correct. The significant incidents are reported over the BlackBerry system, the RSAN system. There are certain city managers, obviously the mayor, his chief of staff, myself, the managing director, commanders in the police department who get this information. And in the last 12 or so hours, we've had six shootings, two stabbings, and one of those shootings resulted in a homicide.
So why is this such a violent city? And I know we have done full hours, and I'm sure you have talked about this and thought about this for many more hours than that.
Yeah, I mean, we'll need much more than the hour you have allotted to this show to come up with the solutions and explore all the issues. But I think that something exists in culture today in the city, in certain neighborhoods in the city. I remember years ago when I was a kid, you had an argument, you had a disagreement. There was a fight, a fist fight, and that was it. People walked away. If you look at the statistics, of the 209 homicides that have occurred year-to-date in this city, 86 of them, or 41%, were over an argument. Mm-hmm. So we're a violent city. In areas of the city, they settle, the folks settle their disagreements with resorting to gun violence and think nothing of taking someone else's life.
And is it fair to say that when we're talking about this level of violence, we are talking about specific areas or specific neighborhoods in Philadelphia? It's not necessarily all over the city.
Exactly. I mean, we're talking about very small areas of the city, and I'm sure if your listeners are aware of how we break the city down into police districts and divisions, it would come as no surprise that the 22nd District, the 39th District in North Philadelphia, the 24th and 25th in East Division, areas of South and Southwest Philadelphia, contain the most gun violence. Mm.
Dorothy, let me turn to you, and you've been a guest several times on Radio Times to talk about this issue, something that obviously affected you so personally. But when Michael talks about a kind of a culture of violence, does that make sense to you?
It does. It does. We did a presentation at Mercy Vocational Tech School, and the dean of students asked that same question. He, I guess, would be about your age, Mike, and he said, "Yeah, I don't understand it, because when I was growing up, you know, it was, you know, kind of same situations, but it was not resolved with a gun. You know, folks had conflict, but they wouldn't resolve it with shooting someone to death." And he had the same question. Why is it happening now? Mm-hmm. I think it is a culture. I think it's a culture of violence that is acceptable. It's a mindset that has been a part of the culture of many of the young people that are growing up today. I'm just going to go back a little bit. There was a woman, and you may remember, C. Dolores Tucker.
Oh, sure.
Years ago, she had this campaign about the video games and the music and the language and the violence that was, and people looked at her like she was crazy. And I kind of thought myself even back then, like, well, it's just a video game. It's just a song. People don't, you know, buy into that. But they do, especially young children that are at risk anyway, or angry anyway. You know, they're being raised in situations where maybe it's not the best and the healthiest. So they do buy into that type of mindset. And I think that is what has happened over the years. There's been a culture that has been developing over the years with the music and the games. So now a 19-year-old or a 16-year-old finds it okay to handle a conflict or dispute with a gun, because that's what he's been seeing and hearing. That has been his daily dose each day of his life growing up. Or maybe seeing violence even in his home with his parents. You know, the conflict that young people have, you know, moms and dads. The violence sometimes is more than we used to see. So,
and sadly, unfortunately, as we saw yesterday in the paper, the police made an arrest of a 13-year-old who was committing burglaries with a weapon. It turned out to be a BB gun, but it was a silver handgun out in West Philly. He was holding up at least, I think, five people.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right.
This is also a city with a high level of poverty. And do you think poverty also, as you were describing, Dorothy, popular culture, but also you add that to families at risk or maybe chaotic families, then you throw in poverty.
I think it's no coincidence that if you look at a map of the city, and we've done this, and they're called heat maps, and you plot the areas where most of the crime occurs, in this case the shootings and the homicides, you see the areas where they occur, and then you overlay that with another map that shows the poverty level, the unemployment level, the levels where education and health care are deficient, and not surprisingly, you'll see that occurs in the same neighborhoods. And, you know, also coincidentally, when you take a look at the releases from the Philadelphia prison system and also the State Department of Corrections and where those folks go back to in the city, it's generally the same areas.
Right. What about just the proliferation of guns? And again, this is a topic we've done before. You're rolling your eyes at me, Dorothy, but the proliferation of illegal guns in Philadelphia. So we're talking about all the sort of ingredients that seem to have come together. How pernicious a problem is that?
That is a big piece of it. I mean, you know, it's crazy to think that a 16-year-old can get his hand on a handgun, a legal handgun, before he can a textbook. You know, there are so many guns in the communities that we're talking about here where the violence is, you know, that a young person knows where to go and get a gun. So if he's angry and out of control for whatever the reasons and there's conflict and he knows where to get that gun and he's already heard and seen day in and day out that violence is okay from the messages that he receives each day, then yeah. Yeah, and availability of guns. And we've done a lot of stuff, and as you said, we've been on your show and talking about this before. Right. But there's not a lot that's being done. And it's not about taking guns away from responsible gun owners. It's about the illegal guns in the communities that end up in the hands of teenagers and people who should not have them.
Well, Michael, this is a big problem the city is looking at. And just to add another anecdote, a man on a SEPTA subway, I believe.
SEPTA train.
SEPTA train had a bag of guns, including an AK-47. Thank goodness a passenger told the authorities and he was taken off that subway.
Right. I mean, the individual had an AK-47. He had a handgun. He had a hunting knife. I think he had drugs and some cash. Who knows where he was going and what he was doing, but I don't know the woman who alerted the authorities, but we all owe her, I think, our gratitude, because, you know, very conceivably she saved some lives. And, you know, kudos to the SEPTA police for acting quickly and making this arrest. And Dorothy's correct. I mean, there are just the proliferation of handguns and long guns in the city, it's staggering. Right. And because there exists that culture of violence, I mean, we wouldn't see the level of death, I don't think, if the handguns were not as readily accessible as they are.
But if the kids know where to get the guns,
of course.
Does the city of Philadelphia know where to get these guns?
Well, we do know that in certain neighborhoods, guns are traded, they're rented. You can go to certain speakeasies or to bars and you can rent a gun. In certain neighborhoods, the gun is passed around from people to people, and, you know, people know where to go to get them.
Right.
You know, we develop that information. When we have that information, we get warrants and we search those locations. We search those individuals. That's part of our partnership with the federal government and some of our state partners as well. That work.
But do you need, I mean, as the public safety officer in Philadelphia, do you need more stricter laws, or do we need enforcement of the laws that already exist?
Again, I don't know if we have enough time to answer that question, but I think as the mayor said earlier this year when we were out in Strawberry Mansion High School, I think it was January 27th, and he announced his crime plan, you know, we have laws on the books, and let's enforce those laws, and let's, you know, have the judges sentence accordingly when we find individuals in violation of those laws. So we do have the tools at our disposal. I think it's a matter of, you know, coordinating our enforcement efforts, coordinating our prosecution efforts, letting the judges who in this city are independently elected, they're all independently elected officials,
right,
know that this is important to the community. As I think it was reported a couple days ago in the Daily News, there was an individual who had 7 previous arrests, and he was just sentenced, I think his name was Jerome Hill. He was out of the 24th District. He had 7 prior arrests. He had probation, got little jail time. He was sentenced to 8 years recently. This individual was somebody who we were targeting through our GunStat program. And, you know, the captain of the district, Captain Voigt, and members of his district, Max Nachman from Ceasefire, Pennsylvania, some community activists were in court and showed the judge that this is important and this mattered. And this individual got 8 years in state prison.
Dorothy, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that we definitely need to, you know, monitor what judges are doing in terms of sentencing, things like that. But I also think that you talked about whether we need gun laws and or just enforcement. There was a gun law that we were really fighting for, and it had to do with loss of stolen guns. And that got flushed. You know, people couldn't get enough, you know, support for that. Now, why would you not want to report a gun that's lost or stolen? A lot of these guns that are lost or stolen end up in the hands of the people that we're talking about that are committing these murders. So why not have a gun law like that in place? But it didn't get passed, and it didn't get the support it needed.
And you're talking about the legislature in Harrisburg.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, there was a lost or stolen bill was passed in Philadelphia by the city council. Mayor signed it along with some other bills. We had a challenge to several of those. Some were upheld, some were not. But currently, as you're probably aware, Marty, and maybe some of your listeners will be aware, that there's a bill pending in Harrisburg. Off the top of my head, I don't remember the number. But essentially, the provisions are that if the city of Philadelphia or any municipality in the state of Pennsylvania enacts their own local gun legislation, any individual who is affected by that, so they're giving standing to anybody, essentially, can challenge that law. And if they're successful and it's shown that the local ordinance is preempted, that individual can receive treble damages, 3 times damages from the municipality, plus their attorney's fees paid for. So a more punitive measure against municipalities who are trying to control and regulate violence, you know, I just don't know what they're thinking in Harrisburg. And as Dorothy says, it makes sense. If you lose your gun or you steal your gun, it needs to be reported.
Like if you lose your car.
Let's take a very short. Fair enough. Let me take a let us all take a very short break. We're going to get back to our conversation with our guests and open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499, talking about what to do about the level of violence and, in many ways, gun violence here in the city of Philadelphia. Talking with Michael Resnick and Dorothy Johnson Spite. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The Wilmington University College of Business supports WHYY and offers MBA programs for business professionals in the Philadelphia region. Accredited by the IACBE, their programs are designed to prepare graduates for leadership roles in the global business environment. Specialties include accounting and finance, healthcare administration, homeland security, and more. Courses begin every 8 weeks and can be completed 100% online or at locations throughout the region. More at wilmu.edu/MBA.
I'm Catherine Lanford. Coming up on America Abroad.
If you don't have a civil society where kids learn to respect a Christian or a Jew, you're going to have major problems.
How will religious minorities in the Middle East fare in an era of revolution and the rise of Islamist governments? Religious minorities in the Middle East on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
Playwright, director, and actor Afa Fugard is best known for plays that dramatize the harsh realities of apartheid-era South Africa. And even though apartheid is over and he's in his 80s, he finds he still has a lot to say.
I have a greater sense of adventure at this moment in my life than I ever had in the past.
South Africa's Afrofugard is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're talking about gun violence, violence in the city of Philadelphia. Michael Resnick is with us. He's the city of Philadelphia's director of public safety. Also with us is Dorothy Johnson Spite, executive director and founder of Mothers in Charge. It's a nonprofit organization. They work on violence prevention and intervention programs. And she helped to found this organization after her son was shot and killed on December 6, 2001. And this was apparently an argument over a parking space in Philadelphia. And Dorothy, one of the reasons we wanted to have you here is to help us humanize this very troubling problem of violence and the kind of impact that it has on family members and on extended family and on the community itself. And you have talked about what happened to your son before, but I want to make sure our listeners understand how you became so involved in this issue.
Yeah. As you stated, my son, colleague, he was 24 years old, and he was shot to death over a parking space in December of 2001. Initially, I wanted to die. I mean, I didn't think that I would survive his death. He was a college graduate. He was actually getting ready to go back to get his master's degree and was kind of doing all the right things with his life. Ran across a very angry person who was totally out of control, and shot him 7 times and killed him over this parking space. During the court proceedings, we found out that the person who purchased the gun was actually the girlfriend. Ernest Odom Jr. could not have purchased a gun because he had a long criminal, about 13 pages, starting at the age of 16 years old. Before he murdered colleague, I just wanted to add, he had murdered someone else. So in July of 2001, he murdered Justin Donnelly. He was 19. And then 5 months later, 2 blocks from where Justin was murdered, my son was killed. Ruth Donnelly is the mother of Justin, and she is also one of the founding members of our organization. Mm-hmm. We came together in January after our children's death. But the woman who was living with this person, Ernest Odom, purchased a gun because, as I said, he couldn't have purchased a gun himself. And that was her testimony at the trial. There are so many communities that are affected across the city by violence, and unfortunately, the piece that we see on the 6 o'clock news or we hear, read in print, is the actual event. But you don't get to see and share in the journey, the traumatic, awful journey of that family and the grief experience. And that is something that is going to have a long-term impact on this community and especially our children. You know, children today are traumatized daily by the violence in their community. And you wonder why they can't go to school and be at their best, you know, because they're losing the potential to be the best they can be because they're living in communities where they know the sound. I had a young 10-year-old tell me that he knew the sound of a gun. Mm. He knew whether it was I don't even know all the guns, if it was a AK-47 or if it was a Glock, by the sound, because he hears the sound so frequently in his neighborhood at night. So the effect of violence on our community is so far-reaching that we don't begin to even look at that. And I think we should. It's traumatizing our communities across the city and across the country, and especially our children, our most precious gift.
Well, and it sounds like what you did was to take this grief that you had, as you said, you wanted to die along with your son, but took this grief and poured it into this organization that has been doing such important work.
Absolutely, absolutely. Along with other courageous women who are on the front lines every day, who could have laid down and died with the kind of pain that we experienced. But instead, you know, with our pain and our anger and our tears, we decided to turn it into something that could be, you know, a step in the right direction in terms of making a difference around this issue and also not having our children, our loved ones, die in vain.
Michael, Dorothy is talking about really traumatized families and traumatized communities, children that know the different sound that a different kind of gun would make. Are we talking about, and these hot spots in Philadelphia, we're talking about traumatized communities, largely speaking?
Essentially, yes. And as part of our crime-fighting plan that the mayor announced and the initiatives that the department is undertaking, realizing that it's not just an enforcement and a prosecution effort, we're also involved. It's more of a holistic approach. We have a program called Philly Rising, which the managing director, Rich Negrin, oversees. He's got an individual by the name of John Farrell and his staff do an excellent job. They identify certain areas in the city, and many of the hot spots are in those areas. And they come into the community, and instead of working top down by saying, we know that you need this and we're going to do this. They come into the communities, they look for community to organize, and they ask the community, what do you need from the city? What help do you need from us to make this community a better place for everybody to live, for the children to grow up, mm-hmm. For people to live their lives? And, you know, we convene those meetings. The community makes the suggestions. The city brings those resources to bear. And we work with the community to help them achieve the things that they would like to have their community sort of grow and prosper. And then once they're established to a certain point and they're self-sufficient, we'll move on to the next community.
And when you ask them what they want, what do they tell you?
It varies by community. One of the communities, one of the Philly Rising communities is Market East, so that's a commercial corridor, and obviously it's a little different than some of the neighborhoods. But generally when you go into the neighborhoods, they'd like a rec center open, city pools open, they'd like computer labs in the library, they'd like the abandoned buildings cleaned up or knocked down, they'd like the overgrown weeds and the lots taken care of. So these are the types of things that we come out and help them. Because many of the abandoned lots and many of the abandoned buildings are places where, as you're probably aware, drugs are stored and guns are hidden. And if we can clear those out of the neighborhoods and give the neighbors a sense of, you know, community pride and the beautification of the areas, I think that goes a long way to help.
But would it be fair to say that if we're talking about a small percentage of the population responsible for a large percentage of the violence, that if the city was able to arrest them all and take away their guns, that this would be a safer place?
If the city were able to arrest all, I can't argue with the logic of that statement. If we were able to arrest all the individuals out there committing the crimes and taking away all their guns.
But we're talking about a small percentage.
Sure. We develop that information through good criminal intelligence. We develop that information from tips from citizens, and we act on that information. As I said earlier, we have a program called GunStat, which is kicked off, I think, in January of this year. The district attorney, Seth Williams, and our police commissioner, Charles Ramsey, chair that meeting. It's held every month in the district attorney's office. All the commanders from these hotspot areas, along with their divisional counterparts in the district attorney's office, are present, and we identify individuals and we identify locations, because these hotspots generally move around a little bit. So we coordinate our enforcement efforts and our prosecution efforts. And through that effort, we're able to identify individuals, take out an individual. Another one, unfortunately, comes up and takes their place. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things the mayor did back in January was ask that the top 100 wanted in Philadelphia be posted on the city's cable network, Channel 64. And of the initial 100, I think over 80 of them have been arrested.
Really?
But we still have a top 100 list, because there's others who come along and take their place.
Dorothy, let me ask you, and this is broadly speaking, and it obviously is going to vary from community to community, but how would you characterize the relationship between the police department and various, especially these hotspot communities in Philadelphia?
I can't speak so much for the hotspots in the community. I can speak to the fact that Police Commissioner Ramsey has quarterly meetings with several of the community organizations to provide us updates and things that are going on within the police department, and to also have dialogue in ways that the community and the police can work better together. Is it enough? I think it needs to be more, mm-hmm. but that's what I see. And Police Commissioner Ramsey is doing, I think, the best job he can, given the situation. I think if there's more community relationships, building kinds of efforts, that we would see the police and the community working closer together to address the community issues. And homicide in the communities, the violence in the communities is a community issue.
Sure.
You know, we're the ones that are going to have to be a partner in ways to solve it. It can't just be all police or all, you know, administrative city hall administration people and things like that. It has to be, you know, a combination of community as well.
And what you can probably figure out I'm getting at is, and I don't know if you like this phrase or not, the no snitching culture, but do you see that as a problem?
Definitely it's a problem. Definitely it's a problem. And again, it's another message or concept that some parts of the community have bought into. Luckily, the young lady on the Scepter train didn't feel that way. You know, as Mike mentioned earlier, we would have had a different kind of an outcome with this gentleman, this person who had these guns on the subway. So I think it's important that the community feels a sense of connection instead of a disconnect with the police, so that they feel comfortable sharing information and feeling that it will be treated in a way that is confidential sometimes if it's about their safety. So I think that there needs to be more efforts to develop that community and police relationships. When I was growing up, you know, you knew the cop on the corner. You went to him. It was almost like he was your confidant. You know, you talked to the officer, whatever his name was, you know, on that corner. He walked that beat. He was a part of that community. We don't see that so much today. There's a large number of new police officers that will be coming onto the streets of Philadelphia, and I understand they have to be on the feet, on their feet in the streets. So I think if any time ever they need to really start to build relationships now, these young officers will be walking the streets in our communities. And, you know, it can be good, you know, if a relationship is established, you know, with community leaders and people like that. I think that's what's needed.
Hold on to that thought. I just need to quickly reintroduce you just so everyone knows who our guests are, and that's Dorothy Johnson Spite. She's the executive director and founder of Mothers in Charge, a nonprofit here in Philadelphia working to reduce violence, prevent violence, also to intervene for children who and communities that are at risk. Also with us is Michael Resnick. He's the City of Philadelphia's director of public safety, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments for our guests, do give us a call. Michael, I know you want to talk about that as well.
Right. I just wanted to pick up on what Dorothy was saying in terms of community policing. I think Commissioner Ramsey has done an excellent job. He's the head of the Major Cities Chiefs organization, and he's a firm believer of community policing. He's sort of reorganized the department into police service areas, or PSAs, and it's his theory, and he put into practice that police officers who are assigned to a particular neighborhood who will walk the beat will get to know the community. They'll get to know who the good people are. They'll get to know who the bad people are. They'll get the people will see those officers. They'll be visible. They will come up to those officers, provide information, let them know who's doing what and where. And as the commissioner tells all new officers at graduation, get yourself a comfortable pair of shoes because you'll be walking a beat for at least a year. And with respect to Dorothy's comment in terms of no snitching, unfortunately, you know, it's pervasive in the city, but in terms of trying to combat that, the department has instituted a text-to-tip line. So you can be anonymous. You can text us with information. It will be anonymous. There's an application, iWatch Philly. You can download it on your smartphone. You can send us pictures. You can send us video. You can send us just texts with information. We have a website, PPD Online, where you can email us tips. Obviously, you can pick up the telephone and call. You can call the Citizens Crime Commission. There are many, many avenues, many venues for citizens to give us information, which will be anonymous.
But why do you think they don't?
Maybe they don't know about it. I didn't.
Well, okay.
I'm hearing this for the first time, so that's great. I mean, I think that's excellent. And you've got to be being able to get information the way young people are communicating today. So I think the texting and the email, and that's great. But to get the message out there to people to let them know that there's a possibility that they can do this without having to be face-to-face with, you know. Right. So I think that's real great.
Right, and that's realizing that that's how the newer generations are communicating. So that's why we implemented these programs. And if what Dorothy says is true, then I guess we need to do a better job of publicizing them and making the city aware that those venues are available.
But do you think people are reluctant to get involved for fear they're going to have to go to court, or that they know this person? I mean, they might live next door to them. Maybe they're in their own family. Maybe they're implicated as well.
Sure, that's always a fear. You know, the city did increase the amount of money we fund for victim witness protection relocation. But yeah, that I'm sure that is a part of it. You can provide us with information anonymously. You don't have to come forward. You can give us enough information that a detective can begin an investigation. Just, you know, give us a name, give us an address, give us a description. You know, give us some information. There was a shooting up in Logan not too long ago where a little girl was shot in the stomach. I think she was 2 years old, and this was during a block party with 200 or so people. We haven't heard anything from anybody in that community about that shooting.
None of these channels that are available to people.
None of these channels.
I hope you let us get that information and help you get it out, because we're on the front lines every day. We're in the community. We are the community. We're the people that are interacting with these families who are being affected by violence. We should have that information to be able to give to the mom or to that community when we go out to the visuals and things like that. We're out there on the front lines. We need to have that information.
Is that part of the problem? And we've done many, many shows about this with various organizations. I mean, is there enough coordination between the city and all these various groups like Dorothy's group that are, as she says, on the front lines?
We try. And if Dorothy's telling me she has not heard of this, then, you know, I think, as I said, we need to do a better job making sure that Dorothy's group and groups like hers who do this work get that information so we can get it out there.
Let me pick up on something, actually, that Michael said about the fact that about half of the incidents in the city involve some kind of argument. And, Dorothy, with the kind of work that you have been doing, working with young people, how do you help people settle their differences without turning to violence?
Well, we do a lot of – part of what we do is prevention and intervention. So we're working in the schools and in the community teaching alternatives to violence, talking about the impact as well of violence. And one of the things that we've done in a place that most people wouldn't think that we'd be is in the Philadelphia prison system. We go in and talk with the inmates that are there on State Road about the impact of violence. Now, not every mother – you know, and our organization is willing or can go in to talk with, you know, potentially maybe someone who may have had something to do with her son or her loved one's murder. But there are some of us that go in on a regular basis, like at least two times a week. Dr. Pat Griffin is a mother who's gone into PIC working with the juveniles for over 5 years now, you know, teaching a curriculum, working with them. So the ones that come back to the community, they come back with a different mindset. We have kind of a captive audience. Most recently at the Philadelphia Industrial Correctional Center, we've implemented a program called Thinking for a Change, which is a national evidence-based curriculum. We're doing a pilot program there now with inmates there. Again, looking at the mindset, you know, they come with a certain mindset, and we have to change that. You know, you can have all the police on the streets, but if people are coming back to the communities with the same mindset or they haven't changed their thinking in terms of how to handle their conflict, it'll be the same thing. Mm-hmm. So while we have this captive audience, we've had an opportunity now to get some men from the community, some of whom have had similar paths of the inmates that they're talking to, and bring a program. As I said, it's an evidence curriculum, strong curriculum that talks about a new way of thinking, believing that everything starts with a thought. So if you change the way a person's thinking, you change their behavior. So this program is a pilot program right now. We're hoping to be able to implement it more, you know, and wider and greater in numbers in terms of the people that we reach on State Road. But a lot of these are dads. They're members in our community. They're family members. And we've got to get inside their head and see what makes them think that the way to handle a conflict, like we talked about earlier, is with the gun.
Yeah.
It has not always been that. It was not always that way.
And we're almost up in a break here, but Michael, if we're talking about this at-risk group, I was reading it's largely male, and it's between the ages of about 14 and 24. Is this the group that we're talking about?
The group that we're talking about essentially is largely male. It's between the age of 18 to 34.
18 to 34. Okay.
It's predominantly African-American men. 81% of them are killed with a handgun. And as I said, it's about 41% of the time it's due to an argument. The interesting thing, I think, also is that given the numbers of homicide victims, about 81% of them have had prior arrests. So they're shooting and getting shot.
We'll pick up on that after this very short break. And that's Michael Resnick. He's the City of Philadelphia's Director of Public Safety. Also with us, Dorothy Johnson-Spite, Executive Director and Founder of Mothers in Charge. And we have some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about what to do about the level of violence here in the City of Philadelphia.
St. Francis Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack happens, the faster the blockage can be opened, the less likely permanent heart damage will occur. St. Francis's cardiovascular team has worked to reduce the time it takes to get a patient from the ER to receiving life-saving catheterization procedures to 50 minutes or less, versus the 90-minute national average. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
To the women who say they are not feminists, Catelyn Moran asks,
what part of liberation for women is not for you? Is it the freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man that you marry?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Moran about her new book, How to Be a Woman. It's a bestseller in Britain. She's a columnist for the Times of London. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A one-time climate change skeptic now says global warming is real and, for the most part, humans cause it. Also, from the 100-meter dash to the decathlon, yay, it's track and field time in London. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the level of violence in the city of Philadelphia, specifically gun violence, and how this violence is affecting residents who live in various communities that are considered hotspots in the city. And again, talking with Dorothy Johnson-Spite and Michael Resnick. And we have a full bank of calls here. Let me see what Jackie from, looks like Elkins Park, has to say. And Jackie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm the mother of an officer, a young officer in the 24th District, and Dorothy, I'm sorry for your loss. As you can imagine, I worry about this every single day, all the time. I guess my question is, one of the concerns, or what I hear, is that there's not a lot of respect from those communities to the police officers, and the police officers often, I think, lose a sense of commitment to the area because they don't feel that way. And conversely, I'm sure that the police officers need to be trained in, you know, to respect those folks in the community. So I understand that they need to report things and they need to tell those officers, but I think there's a basic lack of respect. And I'm wondering, I come from a healthcare background, is there any programs or any organizational staff development that is going on to help the, both the police and the communities learn respect for each other?
Jackie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I know both of my guests want to say something. Michael, can I, or Dorothy, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm not aware of any type of professional development or staff development that you mentioned. I would love to have the opportunity. In fact, I've had some little conversation with the homicide detectives around that. But I did speak a couple days ago to a graduating class of new cadets, police officers, that will soon be hitting the streets. So in that conversation, that's what we talked about. How do you build relationships between the police and the community? I think it's so, so very, very important. And maybe it does need to be more conversation, dialogue, and some type of implementation to address that.
What do you think?
Because I hear you in terms of your concern each day as your loved one leaves the home, and I can't say enough about how I respect the officers that are on the streets, are giving of their time and their life, in some cases, to make a difference in their communities because they're concerned about crime and violence and are there to serve and protect. So it's something that I think that we need to maybe talk more about, especially with the violence in our communities. We're all impacted either directly or indirectly with it.
Jackie, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Michael.
Right, and during an officer's training in the academy, we do have programs that teach officers, sensitivity of different cultural groups, different areas in the city, different ethnicities. There are groups like Dorothy's that come into the academy to speak. We have crisis intervention training for officers. And I believe that a big part of why the commissioner implemented the PSAs is to have officers come out of their cars, walk the beats, meet the people, meet the neighbors, interact with the people in the community. And hopefully in that way, you get a respect for the officer and the officer gets a respect for the individuals who actually live in this community.
Jackie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Before we get back to our callers, I ran across a quote from a spokesperson from the Philadelphia Police Department about violence. The vast majority of violent crimes are committed by a tiny fraction of the population. That's what we've been talking about. He goes on to say that about 80% of the perpetrators and victims have records of multiple convictions for violent crimes, something you referenced earlier, Michael, about sort of killing or being killed.
Right. The majority, 80%, a little over 80% of the homicide victims have prior arrests. So we're talking about individuals who are likely to kill someone or be shot and killed themselves.
And are we talking about the drug trade? I mean, how much do you think drug sales are part of the violence in the city?
I think it plays a big part of it. I know when we have our gun stat meetings, some of the topics that we do discuss are particular areas that see a lot of drug violence. There's a lot of drug trade. There's competing factions for, territory. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the violence in those particular areas is centered around the drug trade.
Right. Do you see it that way, Dorothy?
I do to some degree. I happen to sit on the juvenile homicide review team at the medical examiner's office. So we're looking at every juvenile homicide that happens in the city of Philadelphia. And while it is sometimes drug-related, oftentimes drug-related, it seems like you mentioned, I think, was it 41%?
41% of the
has to do with conflict, arguments. Now, what we may not be looking at in terms of drugs is the drug use. The person who was involved in the violence, were they high? You know, were they smoking wet? Or were they, you know, were they out of their mind in some kind of way that they weren't able to make rational decisions in terms of handling an argument or a conflict, and so they immediately resort to a weapon to handle it because of where they are, mainly because of the drugs that they're using as well. And we know that a lot of young people are smoking weed, and it's all kinds of, you know, chemicals that are in that. So they're not thinking, yeah, you know, where you would have an argument with a friend or somebody. And sometimes they are friends that are killing each other. You know, they're people that know one another. You know, it's not someone who is a, you know, someone that they don't know. It's someone that that's in their community. So that, too, is a part of it in terms of when you talk about drugs. It's the drugs that they're using as well.
Are we talking, and you always have to be careful speaking broadly about groups of people, but nonetheless, Dorothy, are we talking about young people who don't think they have a future or that the future looks bleak to them?
I believe that is true. Yeah, oftentimes it is a pretty dim situation when you've got young people who maybe are not successful in school academically and they're now on the streets, and so the opportunities for them are less. You know, you are not, there are people now with degrees that aren't able to get jobs. So you've got a young person, 16, 17, 18, or in that age group that Mike mentioned, with little education, and so it puts him in a situation where he's not able to care for himself or his family. It's a lot of things that contribute, as we said earlier. It's just so many factors, but poverty is definitely a factor in what we see in the community with the violence.
And, of course, add to that the recession and all the problems that city government now has to deal with, and obviously individuals as well.
Michael. Yeah, of course. I mean, we have a reentry office, the mayor's office for immigration services for ex-offenders, and they deal with trying to help people who have criminal records and come out of jail or prison. And, you know, as you mentioned, we're in a tough economic times, and there are people who have college degrees and have solid work histories who have difficulty finding jobs. So it's going to be even that much tougher for somebody who has a record.
Doesn't the city have an incentive program to employers if you hire someone?
We do. We have a tax program. It's called PREP, the Philadelphia Reentry Employment Program, and that provides with a $10,000 tax credit for an employer who hires a certified ex-offender. And we're not talking about, you know, anybody who just comes off the street with a criminal background. There's somebody who has to go through our program. So they've, A, made the commitment to change, and B, have undertaken all the classes and programs that we require. And then they go through the interview process, and if they're accepted, the employer hires them. The employer is eligible for the credit.
And there's also the Ban the Box.
Ban the Box was some legislation that was passed by the mayor, Councilwoman Miller introduced it, and the mayor signed it. And what that basically says is, on employment applications, there will no longer be a box that asks if you have a criminal record. So that allows individuals with a record to be on a par, on an even footing with individuals who do not. So now you have the opportunity to have that initial interview and impress that employer with your qualifications and your credentials. And then after that, the employer is allowed to ask about the record. But you have that initial opportunity to impress them.
Let's see what Edwin from Germantown has to say. Edwin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Edwin. You're on the air.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. What I was trying to say is this. Sometimes I believe that the parents need to step a little bit up, because the cause of my own, I've been a victim of domestic violence in 2005. So what happened was that my stepson shot me.
Oh my goodness.
In my own house. And prior to the incident, my ex-wife supposed to allow her father to bring a police to search if her son stole his gun. But my ex-wife did not allow her father to come to the house with a policeman. So 3 days after that, the son used the same gun. The father wanted to bring a police to search for and shot me at my head. So it has been devastating, and it's not been, well, since that very time. I've been trying to get myself together since that very time.
Well, Edwin, we're so sorry to hear what happened to you, and I appreciate the phone call. And obviously, you've had to struggle to recover from these injuries. And Dorothy, he also raises the question about families and the responsibility of families. And I'd love to have you talk about that.
Yeah. I think he's right. I mean, we need to see more parental involvement oftentimes. But again, we're talking about poverty in these communities where maybe the caregiver is working 2 or 3, 4 jobs to make ends meet with the family. I mean, again, but we're doing things that we do with the parents. And we do the program at Riverside Correctional Facility with women who are going to be coming home, you know, teaching them to be better parents and teaching them responsibilities and role of being a responsible parent, you know, hoping that that will reduce the number of violent incidents we see from their children or preventing their children from becoming victims of violence.
And what I also hear is about responsible gun ownership as well,
yes,
Michael.
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, this sounded like an individual who, for whatever reason,
right,
didn't come with the police as they should have to make sure that this juvenile, it sounds like, did not have possession of this weapon, which he probably was prohibited from even having.
Right. Edwin, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Michael, I was reading about this, what has been described as a public health approach to violence or gun violence. What does that mean?
I would imagine that if you take a look at the numbers and you see the 209 homicides year to date, 80-some percent of them are African-American males between the ages of 18 and 34. If any other group or that group was injured, killed by some other means or mechanism, you would have, I guess, other resources that would be taking a look at what are the causes and how can we stop this and how can we prevent it. And as they do in public health, you know, you take a look at, well, where are these incidents happening? Where are these illnesses taking place? Where are they clustered? And what resources do we need to combat them and to treat them? So if you look at it from a public health point of view, perhaps we should be doing more than the enforcement and the prosecution that we are now, more legislation, perhaps.
More preventive services,
which exactly.
Is how we think of public health.
Exactly.
Do you want to add to that, Dorothy?
I just agree. I mean, I agree with what Michael said. I just wonder why it's not a model to look at that. It's the leading cause of death among African American males in that age group that you described. So, as you mentioned, if it was some incurable disease, if it was some type of disease, there'd be, you know, immunizations, and there'd be all kinds of resources and dollars coming to that population to address that illness.
Right, and not to be callous, but in terms of the cost, in terms of the cost of enforcement, prosecution, the criminal justice, in terms of treatment in hospitals and rehabilitation afterwards, it costs the city and it costs, this nation billions of dollars.
But it seems to me it also costs the city to have this high level of violence.
Of course.
I mean, just there are enormous costs,
of course,
associated with that.
So the Center for Disease Control looks at health issues across the country, but they're not looking at a leading cause of death among African American males as a health issue.
Mm. And you're calling for that clearly. Let me see what Bernie from looks like Wilkes-Barre has to say. And Bernie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I want to thank you for taking my call.
You're
I think the work your guests are doing is really impressive.
Good.
But I have a potential answer to the question that you were all asking a few minutes ago, is that why aren't people using the tip lines, text-based tip line, mm-hmm, where you text somebody, text the police on your mobile phone or your via the website? And those, in fact, maybe people don't trust the administration to tell them those are anonymous tip methods. When you text someone, you're providing the recipient with your mobile phone number. That's not anonymous. When you send it,
Well, we'll take that. We'll take your point, which, and I'm tossing that to you, Michael.
No, we understand that point, and that point was raised when we were, developing this this tip line. The information does not come directly to the city of Philadelphia. It goes to a third-party host who then sends the information to us. So all we get is the message. We don't receive any of the identifying information.
I appreciate the call. Let me squeeze Jay from Baltimore onto our conversation. And, Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I was saying something similar to the gentleman before me. I was, at one time about 12 years ago, I was involved in something I shouldn't have been in myself. And, it resulted in me and a gentleman handling a conflict and, in a gunfight. And I was surprised when I received the information on witnesses that that had something to say about me. And I was given a list of witness information, and it had all the names on there. It had statements of things that they said, and it had their information, telephone numbers, and some even addresses. And so I thought that I must have been given this by mistake. I said, they couldn't have given this to me, and this was something that was purposely done.
Well, I hate to do this to you, because we have about 45 seconds before we have to end the show, but I don't know. Michael, can I put that to you?
And I guess if this individual was a criminal defendant, what would happen is the police would have to provide the investigative report to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor is required to turn over discovery to the defense attorney. So this individual might have gotten this information from his defense attorney part of the discovery package.
Right, and a defense attorney could share that information, legitimately share
that information.
Sure,
because they would want to send out investigators to see what these people have to say.
Right.
But I think he talks about the fear of people coming forward. That makes it even more so a situation where someone wouldn't feel comfortable coming and giving information if their information is going to be shared like that.
Right. Well, I hate to end on that note, but the clock tells me that we have to end our hour. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And Dorothy, always a good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Dorothy Johnson Spite, Executive Director, Founder of Mothers in Charge. Michael Resnick, thank you for joining us as well. And he's the City of Philadelphia's Director of Public Safety. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.